welcome, Ron. Ron Baker is joining us today, and I'll take a minute and introduce Ron in a second. Ron, are you not muted and you can hear us fine and talk fine? Great. Ron, let me take a moment. I'll quickly introduce the participants to you a little bit about who they are.
Okay.
It might be helpful as you talk to them. Is that they're all graduates of Atticus, and what that means from Atticus's perspective is they tend to think entrepreneurial about their practice. They're clearly have got the distinction of working on it instead of just in the practice, doing it, and they're very open to innovation. And there's about 1,400 graduates, and we've unfortunately had to limit this call to 100, otherwise you'd have more people on this call. And I've asked Ron, and you were very gracious to do this, to set this up in two parts, because this is, from an Atticus perspective, a fascinating conversation for the legal profession to grapple with. And so we've asked you to set up in two parts. One is to sort of discuss it, give your background, your history, your thoughts on it, the things you've learned, why you think value pricing is so critical to the professions. And especially the legal profession, and then let the participants, if they haven't already read your book, go back and read it some more or delve into this more, experiment, and then come back and talk about it with you on a future call. So you are very gracious to do that for us. And so to the graduates, let me introduce Ron very quickly. Ron is a CPA by training. His education is in accounting and economics. He's also obviously the author of The Professional's Guide to Value Pricing. Ron has wrote three books, and he's working on his fourth right now, as I understand it, Ron. And while Ron's book, Professional's Guides, tends to have a strong influence, or excuse me, a strong leaning towards the CPA professionals, it's very applicable to us as well. And Ron's work with a number of attorneys. As a matter of fact, Ron has experience with Bill Cobb, William Cobb. Some of you know him. He's been on our graduate call speaking about compensation systems. So I know that some of you have been successful with experimenting with value pricing, and others of you are grappling with it and asking how it applies to your practice. And I think Ron can address that. And we've asked Mark Chin to join us if he's he may still be on this call. We'll check in a little while. And Mark's been is a family law attorney in Mississippi, and that's really grappled with this. So with that, Ron, I'm going to turn it over to you, and maybe you can talk a little bit about what brought you into this conversation about value pricing and what you've learned and some of your thoughts. And if you're open to it, I'll ask some questions and delve into it with you. And then we can open it up to the participants to ask questions. Is that okay with you?
That sounds great.
Great, Ron. Go ahead. Take it away.
Great. Thanks, Mark. And thanks, Mark Chin, for inviting me and Susan, everybody at Atticus. This is really an honor to talk to a group of what I consider colleagues, even though I'm not an attorney. I guess the best way to explain how I got into it, because I'm often asked why the quest in my life is to once and for all bury the billable hour in the professions. And that is indeed my quest, and I take that quest very seriously. In fact, I set up an entire think tank called the Verisage Institute to do just that. We have 15 fellows and senior fellows worldwide that are either doing this in their practices or are teaching it along with me or are consulting about it. So it's something that I think is essential for, in fact, any profession that still prices predominantly by this mentality that we sell our time. And the way I got into this was when I was practicing as a CPA, and this is back in the late 1980s in my own firm, I held what I thought then was a really good idea, and I still believe today that was a great idea, a client advisory board. We hired an outside facilitator. That outside facilitator sat in a hotel room with about eight of our best clients in our firm. I had a two-partner firm. And the facilitator asked the clients, what do you like about working with these guys? What don't you like? What do they do that drives you crazy? What do they don't do that you wish they would do? And all these types of questions. And we were nowhere near the hotel. It wasn't a two-way glass type of focus group. We did record the we audio recorded it. We did not video record it. And one of my best clients was in that room. And what he said made a major impact on me. He said, I hate dealing with Baker, because every time I call him or want to meet with him, he nickels and dimes me. I never know how much he's going to charge me from year to year for the services that he provides. And he sends me a bill during the very time of the year, and this would be like in April or May, you know, after heavy tax work has been done. He sends me a bill in the very time of the year where he knows I'm cash poor because he had a very cyclical business. He says, of all the people in my life that know my cash flow cycle, I expect my CPA to know it better than I do. And he says, how dare he send me a bill during the times that I'm broke and expect me to pay it within 30 days? Well, folks, you can't sit there and listen to an audio recording of your best client, not necessarily the biggest, just the one that you have a lot of respect for. In a lot of ways, he was a mentor to me. And listen to his complaints and not change. And it really made me evaluate this whole system of why is it that professionals have so many complaints against their price? Why is it that attorneys and CPAs always get complaints about their bills? Why is it that we as a profession around the world write down and write off more than we write up? As just look at any statistics on realization rates. They're all below 100%. We're not even getting what in effect is a manufacturer suggested retail price. And it made me really stop and ponder why other businesses don't get these types of complaints. And it led me to a very simple conclusion. Other businesses, every one of them, no matter how complex the product, gives the customer a price before the customer buys. And that one epiphany hit me, and I said, you know what? There's got to be a better way. So I started to do fixed prices, and I started to implement change orders, and I started to provide unlimited access to my clients, saying basically, in effect, you can call me, meet with me, unlimited. I'm here for you. My firm exists to help you, and I'm not going to throw up a Berlin Wall and impede our communication. I don't ever want you not to call me because you're afraid of a clock running in the background. You know, it's just ridiculous to think that I'm going to give up a chance to help a client maybe get involved in a very complex transaction on the planning side where I can add the most value for fear that he's going to be nickeled and dimed for a $100 phone call. I'll just roll the phone calls and the meetings into an overall fixed price for a client. And that is kind of like an insurance policy for the client. They really appreciated that. I'm also going to give a fixed price and give them certainty in price, try and give them certainty in delivery, just like FedEx does. I mean, FedEx has gone to the point of giving you transparency. We can actually log into their system and exactly see where your package is, which keeps everyone at FedEx on their toes, and also give the client certainty in payment terms, actually work out payment terms that benefit them, not me. Let's structure it around their cash flow. The clients really appreciated this. So we began this whole process of basically fixed pricing. And then we said, well, look, if we're going to price based upon the value of our work, we no longer need to track time. It's not an important issue. The time something takes to do something is not at all equated to the value. I mean, anybody on this call, and you've probably all have done this at one point in your professional career, you can sit in the shower or stand in the shower and come up with just an outrageous epiphany that saves your clients hundreds, if not maybe millions of dollars. Well, that idea in your head could have taken you 1 minute. What do I put on your timesheet? How do I price for that? This idea that there's a direct correlation between the time that an idea takes or advice takes to give or work to perform and value to the customer is just as outdated as Karl Marx's, which is where it comes from, by the way. It's called the labor theory of value, and it's an erroneous idea. I love to tell the story about Merv Griffin, who wrote the theme song for Jeopardy, the game show, in his house on the piano in less than 1 minute. To this day, Merv Griffin earns $7 million a year in royalties. Now, a song is the product of a mind. It's intellectual capital in its purest sense. And I believe the practice of law is intellectual capital in the purest sense. I don't think your clients are buying time. I don't think they're buying hours. I think Ben Franklin was wrong. Time is not money. Abe Lincoln was wrong when he said time is an attorney's stock and trade. Intellectual capital is an attorney's stock and trade. No client on this earth buys time. We don't buy time from our doctors, from our plumbers, from our car companies. We buy results. We buy peace of mind. We buy advice. We buy sleep. We buy all these different things for all these different reasons, none of which have anything to do with time, which led me to think, well, how can I say to my clients that all I have to sell is my time when that's not what they're buying? How can I sell something to a client that they don't think they're buying? That is, in my mind, why there is such an enormous disconnect between how the customer perceives professionals and how we perceive ourselves. We think we're selling time because, yeah, we track it, we fill out timesheets, time and billing programs. It fosters this mentality that keeps us mired in this concept that we sell time, but we don't. We sell a whole host of other things. So that basically led me to totally re-engineer my practice, which, of course, was much better. My clients were much happier. It actually allowed me to reduce the number of clients we serve and sell more to each client, actually increase profitability. It helped me work on the business, not in it, as Michael Gerber would say. And it also just led for better relationships with my clients. There was no more surprises in their bill. There was no more angry phone calls. Why didn't you tell me it was going to take this much? There was no more write-downs. There was no more accounts receivable problems. All of these issues went away by simply having a discussion with the client before we do the work. Now, I know that this sounds completely radical, and there is no way that I can explain how to do all this in a one-hour phone call, which is why I really wanted to do part two, and I'd love to do part three and part four, because this is an enormous issue. But the bottom line is, folks, like every other business, we have to give our clients the price up front. We have to engage in a dialogue about exactly what it is they expect from us. We have to devise up front a scope of benefits. And then we have to turn that scope of benefits into a scope of work, much like any project management. Like if you're going to build a house, you'd start with plans. Mechanic's going to fix your car. He's going to tell you exactly what he's going to do for that price. Now, if something comes up that you don't anticipate, which I know happens a lot in professional services, no problem. We have a thing called a change order. Change order is a wonderful pricing device because it's a communication tool. It keeps the client informed of what's going on with their legal matter, and it keeps them in the driver's seat when there is a change that's going to cost more money, much like a contractor. So the clients, just like we buy everything else in our lives, they want to know the price up front. I can't think of anything that we buy as a consumer where we don't know the price up front. That is a solid economic law. It's also a very solid sociological law, and we violate it at our own peril. And all I'm saying is pricing is a marketing function. And since I know all of you are graduates of Michael Gerber, you know, marketing is about looking outside of your firm and saying, what does the client want? What does the client value? How can we enhance that perception of value, and how can we add more value to the client? Marketing is very outward focused, all focused on the client, whereas pricing is part of marketing. So pricing has to be derived by the value that we're providing to our client. When we look at timesheets, when we look at cost accounting reports and realization reports and utilization reports and all of these metrics that we track as part of the standard practice, they all look inside, and they have nothing to do with value to the client. Nothing. And so I think there is an enormous disconnect about how we think about value and how we think about what we sell and what the client is actually buying from us and what are the true value drivers of what we're doing for them. And all I want to do is I want to take pricing and put it back into its exalted position in the marketing food chain and make firms think about pricing strategically. It's a marketing function. You need, I think, to price on purpose. You need to think about marketing very strategically, not tactically. It needs to fit in with your firm's image, its brand, its niche in the marketplace. It needs to speak volumes about your firm. Your price speaks volumes about your firm. It tells me all sorts of things about how you perceive the value of yourself, just like the price on a Mont Blanc pen sends a completely different message to me than a price on a Cross pen or a Schaefer pen. I mean, price is an enormous signal into the marketplace, and we need to give it the time and attention and creativity and intellectual capital that we give to the practice of law. I want pricing to become a core competency in your firm, just like the practice of law is. And if we look at Fortune 500 companies, because I know best practices, and I hate that term, I like leading practices, or because I'm always assuming that they're going to get better, but if you look at the Fortune 500, almost every one of them today has a pricing department These are people that do nothing but price. They're not marketers. They're not cost accountants. They're not finance people. They are professional pricers. There's actual societies now, Professional Pricing Society, among others, that actually certify professional pricers. FedEx has 66 pricers that are totally responsible for setting prices throughout FedEx. UPS has 150. Airlines have yield management groups. These are people that do nothing but price. And what it forces them to do is constantly look outside of their firms and their companies and say, how are we creating value? What is the customer's perception of value? Because at the end of the day, a price is not determined by the cost. It's not determined by the labor inputs. A price is determined by the value to the customer. Because no matter how much cost you put into something or how much time you put into something or what your profit desires are, it's the value to the customer that's going to ultimately determine what they're willing to pay for it. And so all I'm saying is rather than the normal cost-plus pricing food chain, and if you have paper in front of you, you just may want to scribble this food chain down, but in a cost-plus pricing world like we live in with the hourly rate, we start from the premise that we're going to do a service, and that service is going to cost so much because we're going to track the time as we go. And then we're going to take that cost, we're going to mark it up with, you know, our desired net income, how much the partners want to make, and that's going to set a price. And that price, we're going to hope, is either going to be less than or equal to the value to the client who actually buys the service. Well, if you look at that food chain, service, cost, price, value, customer, the customer's at the end. It's almost like the customer is an afterthought, and yet the customer is the sole arbiter of value in any transaction. Customers don't care how much time you put into something. I'd never ask Porsche to see their timesheets on building my car. It doesn't matter to me. Customers don't ask for cost accounting records when they buy things because what matters to them is the price of that product or service relative to its value. And so rather than having this cost plus pricing food chain of what I just described, I want you to move to a value-based pricing model that kind of flips that whole chain around and says, we're going to start with the customer. We're going to have a discussion of value, of what they're actually trying to achieve and how our firm is going to help them achieve their goals and what is that worth to them. And then that value is going to determine the price. And then we as a firm are going to say, at that price, can we do that service? And invest in the cost it's going to take to turn out the service at a profit we can live with. But it's all predicated from the customer back. So we start with the customer, get the value, then get the price. And in a free market, it's actually the price that determines the cost. And that's what we call the value pricing chain. And that requires that we totally re-engineer the way we practice. We have to have a discussion about price up front. We, in effect, have to do the cost accounting on services before we provide the service. We have to think about, the resources that we have to commit, the time, all of that, which I just consider good project management that you would have to do no matter how you priced. Even if you price by the hour, we should still be doing good project management and try and give the client timelines on when things are going to get done. But if you give the client certainty in price, they're going to be much happier. There's another aspect to this. Not only does the client perceive higher value with a fixed price because you're removing their risk, if that sounds counterintuitive, I want you to think of the mortgage market where customers around this country and indeed around the world will gravitate towards fixed rate mortgages and pay a premium for it because it reduces their risk and uncertainty. Now, when a firm charges a customer by the hour, they're actually dumping risk onto the customer. And the customers don't like to have risk dumped on them, and therefore they limit our reward. They complain about the bill, they complain about how long it took, and they're complaining about it always after the fact because they were never informed up front. Well, if you think about the concept of pricing leverage, what this says is that the time that this basically says a service that is needed is worth more than a service that has been delivered. And if that's true, then the optimal time to price that service from a seller standpoint is when the client needs the service. Once you begin the work, even maybe finish the work and deliver it, the service it's much less valuable to the client. You can't manage value retroactively. You measure value prospectively. And the best time for the firm to learn that the client doesn't like the price is before you provide the service, not after. Once you've got all the time logged in, you send the client a bill and they scream. That's a really rotten time to find out the client didn't like your price. Wouldn't it have been much better to have a discussion with the client up front and learn that they don't like your price? Because then there's several things you can do. You can maybe shift more work to the client. You can reduce the scope of services. You could maybe alter the price. Or maybe you don't do the engagement. This is how all companies now, all enlightened companies, Fortune 500s and others, price their products and services. It's called price-led costing. And the best example of this, probably the company that knows this more than any other company in the world, is Toyota. Toyota doesn't build a car until it knows what it's going to sell for. Now, that means that Toyota's already thought about the value of a car to a customer before they've spent a nickel on R&D. They've already thought about the target price, and then they go to their engineers and say, look, you need to build this car at a cost to us that's going to come in below this price at a level acceptable to generate enough profit. And that forces Toyota to basically control costs better, but it also forces Toyota not to waste money on things that clients don't value. So everything is driven from the customer's perspective. Well, I happen to think that it's much harder to achieve that level of perfection in a company like Toyota than it is in a law firm where you're meeting with clients individually. Toyota does not have the advantage of meeting with every single client and knowing exactly what that client is trying to accomplish. If they did, they would be able to be better pricers because they could customize a price and build a customized car to each and every client. That's a pricer's dream. Lawyers and professionals have that capability of figuring out scope of benefits, scope of work. In other words, what kind of car do you want with what options? You know, do you want Sirius radio or do you want, you know, 8 CD changer, whatever? You can actually figure out exactly what they're going for, figure out the value. That drives the price, and then that price determines the cost that the firm can invest in. It's a totally different way of looking at your business because it's from the outside in, not the inside out. If you look at cost accounting reports and timesheets and all of these other things that we track inside, they only look inside. They say nothing about value to the client. So we don't get enough feedback on the value that we're providing to our clients. The other thing I'd like to point out is, and this is kind of a thought experiment, but I want you to think about the people in your firm that are responsible for pricing right now. Most of the time it's partners, maybe some high-level associates, but mostly it's partners that do pricing. And I just want you to think about their competence in that, because I happen to think that pricing is a competency. It's becoming a separate body of knowledge. It's becoming its own professional distinction because it is a totally different way of looking at the universe. And think about the competence of the people that price in your firm and put them into three categories. They're either acceptable, in other words, they do a pretty good job, they're mediocre, or they're wimps. Now, I happen to think that most partners that do pricing in professional service firms are either mediocre or wimps. And pricing is the number one lever of profitability in your firm. There's lots of studies on this by McKinsey and other consulting firms, but basically, if you cut your firm's fixed cost by 1%, you can get a 2% increase in profit. If you cut your variable cost by 1%, you can get almost 4% increase in profit. If you go out and rainmake and add to your revenue by 1%, you can get almost an 8% increase in profit. But folks, if you increase your price by 1%, you get almost a 12% increase in profit. And those figures I just read come from a manufacturing study, not professional service firms. It's even more dramatic for professional service firms. So in other words, rainmaking, cutting costs, being more efficient is dwarfed by the effect that smarter pricing has on your firm's bottom line. And that's why we want you to think about it strategically. Does that mean that we're going to reduce all pricing errors? Of course not. You're going to make pricing mistakes. We're making tons of pricing mistakes now with the billable hour. We leave all sorts of money on the table, and we don't even know it because our metrics are not sophisticated enough to capture it. At least in a value model, you're constantly testing your price against the value that you're delivering. And even if you are a fantastic rainmaker that can go out and get client after client after client, I would warn you that if you bring those clients in at the wrong price, all you're doing is laying mediocrity and layers of mediocrity onto your firm. You've got to bring that new business in at a good price that's commensurate with the value that you're providing to your client. So what we actually want firms to think about is, look, not everybody's a good pricer, and that's okay. Just because you're a partner doesn't mean you're blessed with the competence to price. What needs to happen is we need to turn over the pricing function to a group of people in the firm that are willing to get certified, that are willing to read about it, that are willing to constantly invest in their intellectual capital and actually take responsibility for the pricing function. This is exactly what the Fortune 500 have done, and I think it's time, it's beyond time, that professional service firms do the same thing. I would go so far as to suggest two more steps. I would suggest that the firm create a pricing cartel, a group of people, maybe four or six, it depends on the size of the firm, that are responsible for pricing, and I would also suggest that somebody in the firm assume the role of what we call a CVO, a Chief Value Officer. This person is the eyes, nose, and throat of the customer. They make sure that everything being done internally somehow, somewhere, adds value to the customer, and they constantly have communications with customer about value. They actually sit down with clients before work is started, and they actually go out after and do postmortems, or what we call after-action reviews, on the work that has been done to see how much value was created, how more value could have been created. This helps them price better for the next time. So pricing is an art, but it's also a skill like golf or tennis. And as you do it more, you get better at it. And we have found that if you don't give the responsibility for pricing and turn it over to a specific group of people, that it doesn't get done correctly, and it gets done very suboptimally. Because if you are going to price based on the model that I'm suggesting, which is fixed pricing up front, then you're going to have a group of people that really think about it strategically and have built up an intellectual capital knowledge bank, if you will, around the competency of pricing. That's exactly what the Fortune 500 have done. So I know that's a really broad sweep at the canvas of where we are and where we need to go, but that's how I got here, and that's the road we're on, and all I'm doing is I'm looking out in the rest of the world, and folks, I am seeing a pricing revolution out there. Literally, it's going on all around you. Companies are becoming much more sophisticated at pricing. If you doubt that, just walk into a Starbucks and look at the menu. Starbucks offers you all sorts of value options at all sorts of different prices, even for the same cup of coffee, even though the cost difference between a venti and a tall is nothing. It's not even penny. But the price difference is substantial because they're thinking about value and they're constantly testing their prices. We need to rise to the same level of sophistication and competency when it comes to pricing. We can no longer just say our price is determined by how many hours we put into something. This is absolutely archaic and absolutely destroys value. I don't think any lawyer entered the profession to bill the most hours. I think the timesheet is a terrible tool. I think it keeps us locked in the mentality that we sell time. I don't think it's a good cost accounting tool. I don't think it's a good productivity tool. I think there are better ways to measure and judge the performance of an attorney rather than looking at billable hours. We all know that an attorney can look great on the timesheet and have a really bad service attitude or be pissing off their colleagues in the firm. The timesheet simply just does not measure the most important characteristics of a successful attorney. So part and parcel with throwing out the billable hour, we're never going to, I think, in my humble opinion, we're never going to achieve that unless we throw out the timesheet, because it's the timesheet that keeps us mired in the mentality that we sell time. So with that, Mark, I know I ran for about 30 minutes, so with that, why don't we open it up for questions if you want.
Are you going to give a few specific, or could you give even one or two specific examples of how the difference between, you know, a particular project? I missed the beginning, and I don't know what your practice is like, but could you give an example of the type of service you provide for clients in your practice area and how, you know, value pricing, as you've discussed it, yields a better result and why? Because I can't get my arms around this yet.
Well, let me jump in. This is Mark. I'm sorry, who is that speaking?
Jim Perricone.
Oh, hey, Jim, it's Mark. Jim, I'm going to hold that question. For one thing, I think we'll come back to that, but just, you know, Ron is a CPA, and he's talking about professional services in general. He had a lot of experience with law firms as well as CPA, so we can talk about that and give you some specifics. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure if Mark, are you on the, Mark Chen, are you on the call yet? If you are, you may be muted. I'm not sure. Susan, does Mark have an organizer's code?
Mark is unavailable right now. Mr. Powers, he just stepped out. He'll be back in just a few minutes.
Okay, good. When he jumps on, would you just ask him to just announce himself? Jim, if you're okay, I'm going to come back to that in a second.
Sure.
And give Ron do that. Ron, I just want to let you know you're doing a great job. This is a you're going, and I agree with you, two calls may not be enough because we are in this profession. There's a we're embedded in the hourly conversation, and we certainly need the revolution. And I think most people on this call are innovating or thinking about innovating or trying to find another way to it.
Absolutely.
I love I think you're singing the same song that most on this call want to hear, is to focus on the client, find out what they want, what their need is, what their value, and then how do we price to the value we're providing.
Right.
So it really, you're doing a great job. And let me just, before we take a few other questions, let me just remind everyone else, and I think if you've heard any Atticus conversation, you've heard us talk about this, that I assert that we have no choice but to take on Ron's challenge and experiment with this and keep pushing this for the rest of the profession. If we don't look at all of the other dynamics facing this profession, just look at supply and demand. In 1968 or 67, we had 168,000 licensed lawyers in this country. By 1980, that number was up to 670,000. In the 90s, it was 860,000. We've topped 1.2, 1.3 million licensed attorneys in this country. That translates for one attorney for every 340 Americans. And that's man, woman, and child, not necessarily clients. If you're in my home state of Florida, that's one attorney for every 260 Floridians. So, and we're in a profession that is still graduating 36,000 law students every single year, and a profession where many attorneys are not leaving when they used to. They're staying longer to get reap some of the financial rewards they weren't getting earlier. This profession has changed dramatically. And, Ron, we're at Atticus of the assertion that we have no choice but to take on your revolution.
Mark?
And it'll be different. Yes.
This is Bill Norman. How are you?
Hey, Bill.
You know, I came in a little late on the phone call, but I got the essence of what was being said, and I agree with the concept. My problem is, and I don't know how to get around this, and I'd welcome some thoughts on it, what do you do when a transaction requires open-ended negotiations and you're not the only party involved? I mean, anyone who, and we represent, the nature of our practices, we represent businesses. We don't deal with closed-end transactions for the most part, although on occasion we may draft something of an internal document so it's closed-end in that I can judge what it will take for us to put it together. But a lot of times we're involved in acquisitions, divestitures, employee relations, you know, all sorts of agreements that require another side to the transaction, and there's never any way to judge whether the attorney on the other side is experienced, number one, and really has a handle on what should be or should not be in that document. And then, two, clients always get involved, as they should, and they're, you know, they hammer out the guts of the agreement, but then when you start to put it together, there are a host of issues that crop up that you need to deal with. How do we as attorneys figure that out in advance when it's open-ended?
Bill, I'm going to I've got a response to that. I'm going to let Ron, who's the expert, answer that as best he can, and I'll jump in perhaps. And I think, Jim, this will address some more of the examples that you were talking about. And then when Mark Chan, I'd like to hear his experiment. Ron, do you want to take that on?
Yeah, the open-ended transaction. I understand that there are some transactions where you just don't know what the other side is going to do, what the judge is going to do, and all of that. I do not think that obviates the need to give a fixed price. If I take my car to a mechanic and there's something wrong with it, he doesn't know what he's going to say to me. He's going to look. I'm going to charge a couple hundred bucks to diagnose it. I think the open-ended transaction calls for a couple different strategies. One is you put it into phases. You figure out what you can know about it, and say we're going to do up to this point in this transaction for this price. Once we get 80 or 90% done with this first phase. Then we'll have a good idea of what might be going on in the second phase, and then we'll give you a price for the second phase. So I think you break it down into phases. Another pricing strategy for that open-ended, you know, business sale or something like that is to use a retrospective price clause where you're going to do whatever it takes to effectuate the client's transaction, and then not only may you get some form of minimum price, but you'll also get some form of tip clause, the American Bar Association refers to it specifically as a retrospective price clause, where the client says, look, you've done a great job, and, you know, here's an additional bonus for what you've done for us. Now, obviously, there's issues with the nature of the relationship, how long you've known the client, things like that, but that is a very effective pricing strategy to use in some of these open-ended agreements. But even if you can't use a tip clause for some reason, because you don't know the client very well, or it's a brand-new client, I still think the best strategy is to break it down into phases. This keeps the client in the loop. This keeps the client informed of what's going on with their matter, and it's a much better communication device. This is not just a pricing strategy. This is also a communication device with your clients, and it also forces firms to do better project management. I mean, the last thing I want to hear from my attorney is that, you know, it's so open-ended, you don't know what's going on. I mean, folks, I'm coming to you because you're an expert. You've seen this before. I know you know the different paths that we can go down far better than I do. Now, yeah, there could be 10 different ways this could go, but I expect you to be able to warn me about those different ways and maybe even project for me a price for those different ways, because you're the pro from Dover. This is exactly why I'm paying you. You know, you don't want to be wheeled into the operating room and hear the anesthesiologist go, wow, look at that, I've never seen that before. That doesn't instill a lot of confidence in me as a client. I want to know that you've done this a million times, you know what you're doing. Yes, I realize there's some uncertainty here, but help me through this. But you still need to give me a fixed price on what you do know and what you can get your arms around. So I would say phasing is the ultimate answer to your question.
And, Bill, there's a couple of other things you may tack on to there is, you know, if you know any family law attorneys, they'll often, in their retainer, which is somewhat form of this, but they'll put in their own mind, they'll put in a jerk quotient, meaning the opposing counsel they know is a jerk and it's going to run the charges up, and they'll actually put that in their expectation. So it forces us to be better, not only better business owners, but better understanders of the marketplace on how to price the services. Ron, we'll get to something else either on this call or the next one, that Ron doesn't believe in pricing all clients the same. He thinks there's a differentiation in how you price clients, not only just in the variables, but in who the client is, and he'll talk about that. And when it comes to business, there's maybe an attorney on this call. I don't know if he's on right now, but Steve Riley is brilliant at these sort of innovations. And from a business attorney's perspective, Jim, this addresses your question as a practical application. He went out with his business clients, noticed the problems. They would always call in with one quick question. They'd always have a number of problems they had to issue, and they had certain problems that were tolerations, like not keeping their books up. And he set up a small contract with them, an agreement with them, a product with them that would cover their corporate minutes It would cover a meeting with their CPA and their financial advisor for planning as their trusted advisor. It would cover that one quick question, which he said always translated in, I just want to ask a question. It translated, I don't want to pay for this. And he built it into a package, and he sells it as a package to his clients. They love it because they don't feel like they're getting nickeled and dimed every time they call them. They know they've already paid for it. Interesting, and he starts the year off by billing them that fee. So he's got a set package. He starts with an inventory of money in his bank account at the beginning of every year. Interestingly enough, on average, those clients generate another $15,000 in work out of their one quick question.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. I mean, what the power of part of the power of pricing is to bundle your services. Like, for instance, why not offer an entrepreneurial package to new business owners where the firm will, you know, incorporate the company, determine choice of entity, meet with the CPA, do all the things that you need to launch a business, and why not just give a fixed price for that? Some of the work, yeah, might take a little bit longer than others, but on average, you're going to give the client certainty in price, certainty in delivery. They're going to get a scope of benefits that's really clear, and they know what they're paying for. Clients are clamoring for this. And they want certainty in price. Every general counsel I've ever talked to says what attorneys don't seem to understand, and folks, I'm not trying to bash on you. I'm just trying to tell you what I hear from general counsel all throughout the world. Attorneys don't understand that we have budgets in businesses. We have budgets. We have to know what things are going to cost. This excuse that they don't know how long something's going to take is not holding any water anymore, because smart, intelligent general counsel know that there's no correlation between the time that you put into something and the value to them of your work. So I think providing clients with certainty in price and certainty in delivery, and maybe even guaranteeing your work. A lot of law firms out there are offering a service guarantee, not an outcome guarantee, a service guarantee, just like you know service in a restaurant. McGuire Woods in Chicago, and there's other firms out there doing this. That is all a competitive differentiation that allows you to charge a higher price, much like it allows FedEx to command a higher price, because they're guaranteeing their service.
But what is the guarantee of service exactly?
What's that?
What is the guarantee of service? What's the essence of that guarantee?
The essence of it is, Mr. and Mrs. Client, we guarantee your complete delight with our services.
Okay.
And
you'll get a call back within 24 hours. You'll have there's certain standards that you'll meet. Ron, let me just check. Is our friend Mark Chin here yet?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
Hello, my favorite Mark Chin.
First, let me pay homage to the great master, Ron. It's great to be on the same call with
fine,
you.
Mark.
In regard to the pricing, where you don't know where it's going to go, first of all, you have to know your business. So I would say, survey your business, take a look at what each type of case costs, see if you can categorize them and see what the time is in each of them. I've created a pricing checklist, which I'll share with anyone. My email is mark@chinandassociates.com, C-H-I-N-N, and the rest spelled out. But you can create phases for each case. We all know that a divorce case, which I work on, has different phases from pre-filing to discovery to trial. you can create time limits. For example, someone comes to me and says, look, I just want you to negotiate. I don't want to file a lawsuit. I don't want to do any of that. So I'll arrive at a fixed price for negotiation, and then I'll say, all I'm going to do is negotiate. I'm not going to respond to an adversarial complaint. I'm not going to file one. I'm not going to investigate. And I will do this for 2 months for this price. And then I'll usually say, and look, if we haven't resolved it in 2 months, we probably need to stop and figure out what the next direction ought to be anyway. Another thing you do is you'll find in Ron's book, Value Pricing, and probably the firm of the future, I think also is, you know, be very careful in how you limit your services. Say in the contract, I'm going to do X, X, and X. I'm not going to do X, X, and X. If it takes something outside of this contract, a new contract will have to be done. And then finally, something from my days working in the factory is what I call a piecework method. You write a contract and say, I will be available to you on a monthly basis to do everything in your case for blank dollars. If the case goes to mediation, the charge will be blank dollars, and then if the case goes to trial, the charge will be blank dollars, and so you create different prices for different aspects of the work which are likely to crop up during the case. And so it's time limitations, contract limitations, building in prices for things which could happen. And then, of course, Ron talks a lot about the change order, which says if such and such happens, then we have the right, or if you request something in addition to this, we have the right to add an increased price, much the way a builder would. And if you know your business, you know, I believe that law practice is no different than any other business. If you study it carefully, everything's a routine, and you know what can be out of the routine, and if you study it, you can carefully write your contracts to protect yourself. That's not to say you won't get burned, but, you know, there's lots of ways to limit the exposure that your firm has.
Mark, I know that you actually find this, you've experimented with this, you've struggled with this, you've taken baby steps with this, and you're even nervous about how this will play out in your practice in some ways, so it's the right place to be, I say. Can you give a quick story of when you first your first attempt at value billing and what happened?
It's really an amazing story. A fellow called me up, and it was clear in the conference that he was not of the financial means that we normally take. And I said, you really don't need this firm. This firm's a battleship, and you need maybe a PT boat. And he said, no, I want your firm. And so I said, okay. So I took a couple of weeks, actually, to study the situation, and I came up with a plan that I thought was carefully designed around what he really wanted to achieve, which was a quick result with minimum exposure and minimum hassle. And I also calculated what his ultimate exposure was in dollars and difficulty. And I came up with a plan, and I called him up, and I said, here's the plan. I want you to deposit with me $100,000. And the second we sign the contract, you owe me $25,000. My goal will be to close this case within 30 days. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go visit opposing counsel with a fully worked out agreement, and I'm going to tell him this. My client has deposited $100,000 with me, and if you want this deal, you've got 1 week to do it. If you don't want, and I'll write you the check right out of my trust. But if you don't want to do it, all of that trust goes to me to defend the case for the next 100 years. And so the case settled within 2 weeks. The client spent probably three times what he would have spent by the hour, but he has written a testimonial, which is on my website, and you can check it out if you'd like, ChannonAssociates.com, and he's written a testimonial to how happy he was with our service, and it's what Ron is preaching. I carefully looked at what the value was to the client, which was a speedy resolution without hassle, and put a price incentive out there which made me put my entire firm's resources on doing it. And so our firm, instead of becoming time-oriented and ultimately delay-oriented, became project-oriented, and we made it happen. And that client's testimonial is on my website.
It's a great story, Mark.
I owe it all to you, Ron.
Right again.
I'm sorry, who's this?
This is Dorothy Edwards from Bill Neelan in New York.
Hey, Dorothy.
Could you give us that website again?
Well, thank you. It's ChinnanAssociates.com.
Thank you.
That was a great story. This is Jim again. A couple of things. One is, I don't quite get it. Did you get to keep the $100,000 fees, or did some portion of that go towards the actual settlement to pay the other side?
That's an excellent question, and that was one of the keys. And I learned it from an insurance defense counsel many years ago when I was doing plaintiff's work. He sent me a check for the client, and it really shut off my negotiations because the client said, well, I'll take it, you know. And so what I did was I went to opposing counsel and said, I have funds in trust to pay your client her fair share. If she doesn't take it, then it's going to me. So he took her fair share. I got my fee and returned a substantial portion of money to the client. So he had made the decision at the outset that he was prepared to invest $100,000 in this project. And yet he got the result within a couple of weeks' time and got money back. So he was extraordinarily happy. I recently had a guy came to me back in October as a fairly wealthy farmer in the Delta, and he said, I just want you to draft an agreement. I don't want you to do anything else. I don't need any advice. You know, I don't want any fancy big city advice. I can handle this myself. And I said, well, what would you like to pay for that? He said, I reckon $5,000. And knowing what it takes for me to do that work, I said, sold. So we drafted the agreement. 5 or 6 months later, he gets his wife to consent to the agreement. We go enter the divorce. The total cost to us was probably $4,000. He paid his $5,000, and he told my associate when he entered the divorce, I must have caught Mark on a weekday getting such a great price for that work. He thought he got, and he did get great work, but from a time standpoint, I would have lost money on that project had I billed by the hour. Yet he got certainty for which he paid a premium, and then turns around and tells my associate he thought he got a discount. And so none of that is bad. It's all great. You know, we got what we needed, and he got what he needed, and he thought he got a great deal. And that's part of what Ron's talking about, the certainty. He knew what he wanted to pay. He told me what he wanted to pay. I thought it could work for me, and it ended up being a great deal for everybody.
You know, this is Jim. Can I just throw in? I realize when whoever it was that talked about phases, I realized that there are two types of cases. Unfortunately, it's not more than 25 or 30% of my cases, but two types of cases where I use that phasing approach, and it works nicely. It's where a client says, I'm thinking of buying this property. I don't know if it's too contaminated. I don't have a big enough budget. I don't want to get in a big hole. What's it going to cost? And I quote them. I ask them about three questions. I quote them a price of either $1,500 or $2,500, and I said, you won't lose any money. We're going to tell you the likely liabilities, what the risk factors are. And then, so if you can budget that, then you know in advance, you know, that you're going to spend that on a property you may make no money on because you may not buy it. And that's worked kind of nicely, better than the hours. Sometimes we're more and sometimes we're less. The other thing is clients who say, we want to stop this project. We think it was a defective environmental impact statement. I said, well, why do you think it's defective? And they give some half-assed reasons typically. And I said, well, you know, I can't tell you whether it's worth it for you to pay me a lot of money to bring a lawsuit when I get into the issues very deeply. I determine you've wasted, you know, $10,000 or $15,000 or more, $20,000. I'd rather do a quick study at $2,500. I will tell you at the end in a short letter whether I think it's worth it for you to bring a lawsuit or not. You pay me that money in advance. You're going to get that answer, and then we go on from there. And those are two things that I have done where I wasn't thinking about it when you talked about value pricing. That's very good where people just don't know if they have a claim or not, or they don't know if it makes sense for them to buy a certain property.
Well, this is going to be scary. Thanks for that, Jim. And this is going to be scary territory for a number of people on this call. Ron, I'm going to open up maybe one more question. But while we're getting that question, if you could think of an assignment that you would recommend for us, and I would say one would be to read the book. But if you could think of an assignment before now and the time that we talked to you that might be a baby step for some people, I'll open it up for one question. Maybe we can close with your assignment. Is there another question for Ron?
Yes.
Who's this?
Victoria.
Oh, hey, Victoria.
How do you see this as affecting what has been traditionally the contingent fee practice?
What fee practice?
Contingent fee.
I view contingent fee as a form of value pricing. I actually believe that one of the reasons that attorneys are farther down the road than, say, CPAs or advertising agencies that price by the hour is because attorneys historically have not just been tied to the billable hour. You have other forms of compensation. You have probate schedules. You have the contingency fee. You have these other methods of getting paid. And I don't think this will affect contingencies much at all. I mean, I think they will continue because they are a form of value pricing, because they're a form of risk sharing. Really, at the end of the day, what we're talking about is value pricing. When you give a fixed price for a phase or for a project, you are taking on a certain level of risk. Well, that's just general business. Profits come from risk. Profits do not come from billing hours. They come from taking risks. And I'm always amazed when I hear professionals argue that they can't put a price on something because they don't know the cost, they don't know what the judge is going to do, the other side. And I think to myself, what about actuaries that price disaster insurance, earthquake insurance, fire? They don't know when the next quake is going to strike. They don't know how big it's going to be, and they certainly don't know their cost, but yet they give you a fixed premium. Now, that's because they're pricing risk, and that's part of the competency of a professional pricer is to look at risk. And maybe the professions just don't have enough intellectual capital, and hey, if we have to hire actuaries to help us price, maybe that would be a good thing.
Mark, can I email some questions to you for next session? Because we don't have the time.
Please do. Actually, email them, if you would, to Susan.
To Susan,
at Atticus,
I will.
To Atticus Online. And that's a great point for everyone.
Because I think contingent fee percentages can vary as wildly as annual,
yes,
as hourly rates.
Absolutely.
And I see some of the same problems even with contingent fee work.
Absolutely.
So
sure. If you have questions.
The difference with a contingency fee, though, is at least the client is informed up front. They know what that percentage is going to be. There's no surprise.
Right. Which
that's
helps.
A big difference.
And that helps
also
a lot.
Surprises with the hourly bill.
Ron, we have another call scheduled for you. I have to check if Susan's on the line. She could tell us when that is, unless you know when it is, Ron. What would an assignment be that people on this call could take a baby step?
I would suggest a couple things. One, if you go to verisage.com, which is my website, verasage.com, go to the homepage. It's a blog, actually, but go to the homepage under Ron Baker's books. You'll be able to scroll down and find three books that you can download for free in PDF called Burying the Billable Hour, Trashing the Timesheet, and You Are Your Customer List. Now, they're written for an accounting association, but many of the same principles apply to legal firms. I would say start there. Read those. They're about one hour read each. And then I would encourage you, like what Mark has done, to go back and try and do a fixed price. Try and phase a client project. Try and give a fixed price. Experiment with it. The walls in your firm will not collapse. Even if you lose money, you're going to gain a lot of knowledge from it. Have a discussion with the client up front about the project, exactly what they're trying to achieve, just like what Mark did. Get a sense for the value, price commensurate with that value, and then go see if you can do project management and, you know, invest in the cost it's going to take to throw off a nice profit. My guess is you're still going to be tracking time, so you're going to be able to compare, just like Mark did, where he would have been with hourly billing versus what he got with the fixed price. And I think you'll find, even in a one-shot experiment, that your client's going to be happier. You'll probably end up selling more services to that client, and the firm is going to end up making more money with a happier client. I mean, this is a win-win-win all the way around. It's not about ripping off the client. It's not about charging. It's not about facade pricing, bill them till they can scream. In fact, in some areas of your practice, I think your prices might decrease because I think a lot of times we have surgeons piercing ears, and some of our work is overpriced. But by and large, pricing commensurate with value is going to lead to greater profits, greater morale for your firm, a better class of client, and a happier client.
So when we get back together, we should have some. We'll do much more question and answer opportunities, and listen to hopefully people that have taken the first crack, the first bite at value pricing. So, Ron, on behalf of
could you give that website again, Ron?
Yeah, it's verisage.com.
verasage.com.
And go to what section?
And go to Ron Baker's books, or buy Ron's books, it might be. And then you'll see where you can download at the very bottom three PDF books for free. So I'm not asking you to buy anything, folks. I don't expect you to buy any of my books. But read those. They're basically cliff notes to the firm of the future. And it'll give you a really good overview of why I'm suggesting what I'm suggesting and even give you some certain specific examples of firms that have done it.
And this is Mark, and I am suggesting that you buy one of his books, and I'd recommend The Professional's Guide to Value Pricing and getting a chance to read that before we have Ron on the call for the next one. Ron?
Oh, Verisage?
Verisage, V as in Victor.
Oh, Verisage?
For next time, it's Richard Johnston in Fort Myers, Florida. Can you comment on how bar associations and judges are reacting to these pricing models?
Yeah,
I can tell you this really quickly. Bar associations are all over this topic. If you go to the ABA's website, you can see the 2001-2002 ABA Billable Hour Commission Report, which the foreword was written by Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, folks, I've written some nasty things about the billable hour in my day, but Stephen Breyer tore it apart, said it's killing the profession, it's making pro bono work difficult to do, it's destroying the morale, the quality of life, this treadmill that we've got our young associates on, you have to build 2,000 hours a year, is just killing the profession. It's a fantastic report. And I have to say, the ABA has been a thought leader on this issue going back to the mid-1980s with a fellow named Richard Reed, who's written three seminal books for the ABA about why the billable hour needs to go away. And those are all duly noted and quoted in my books as well.
Could you give us that website one last time?
Yeah, it's Verisage, V as in Victor, E as in Energy, R as in Ron, A as in Alan, and then Sage, S-A-G-E, .com.
And I'll have Susan email you. You all will send out one email with a quick recap of when we're going to have Ron on again, the assignments that Ron recommended, and his website. So we'll send an email with that out for you all.
And you'll find resources on my website, too, for lawyers and specific links and other types of reading that you can do on this whole topic, how it affects clients, how it affects timesheets, all of that.
Ron, we're having a lot of people bounce off because they're hitting their appointments, but just brilliant job, Ron. Thank you for taking the lead. Thank you for being out there and creating this sort of conversation. And if you would, everyone, you can take your phones off mute, and if you would, on your way out, just thank Ron and say goodbye to him. Ron, thank you very much for your contribution.
Thank you, Ron and Mark,
for making this available.
Thanks, Mark, Tim. Thank you. And David Spray, if you're still out there, thank you for your email.
You're welcome, Ron.
Thank you, Mark.
Ron, thanks a lot. Great job.
Thank you.
Mark Chen, thank you. Great job.
You're welcome. Thanks, Mark.